Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee. We had a week last week where y'all were able to sleep in a little bit, and now we're back to normal. And we're going to switch up the order a little bit today. We're going to have Representative Franzen come and present her bill, but while she's coming, Representative Lesh, should we have the opportunity? Probably not. To read the through the minutes. Let me.
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. So Representative Lesh moves the minutes of February 22nd. All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. Representative Franzen, let's see here. I will move House File 2391 before the committee and recommend that it be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Franzen, to your bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee. What an exciting day. So before you, there is a bill, and I'll explain it. The Minnesota State Exemptions protect certain property of individuals from creditors. These exemptions apply when a creditor is collecting from a debtor outside of bankruptcy, such as a garnishment or levy, and are applicable to a debtor's property inside of bankruptcy. The Minnesota state exemptions presently protect, for example, a debtor's homestead up to a certain amount, their clothing and household goods and furnishings, among other specific things. There is not anything in these exemptions, though, that protect healthcare savings accounts, and that is the bill before you today. Healthcare savings accounts are accounts that go along with some people's health insurance. In order to open a healthcare savings account, one must have a health insurance policy that is a high deductible health plan as defined by the IRS. The IRS limits annual contributions to health care savings accounts. With the advent of changes in health care over the past decade, these plans have become a lot more common. Presently, Minnesota state exemptions do not protect health care savings accounts from creditors or bankruptcy trustees. This bill protects health care savings accounts from creditors and bankruptcy trustees up to $25,000. People's health care should be protected, and health care providers should be able to receive the money that the law has already set aside to compensate them for their services. People will not be able to shield a substantial amount of money from creditors and health care savings accounts because of the annual limits the IRS sets forth for contributions and the $25,000 limit in this bill. And to my left, I have Nathan Hansen, and he will briefly explain a little bit more, and we can go on.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and any affiliation that you have with the business, or go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Nathan Hansen. I'm a private attorney. I don't have any specific client right now that benefits from this. It's just I've done, among other work, I've done a lot of debtor-creditor work and bankruptcy work for the past 10 years. And this is a problem that where people's health care savings accounts can technically be taken by creditors and more commonly by bankruptcy trustees. Bankruptcy trustees will just take somebody's health care savings account and distribute it pro rata to other creditors instead of that money getting to be dedicated to compensate the health care providers that the law contemplates. There are specific accounts just for this. You can't load up all your money in this or anything like that to try to shield it from creditors. There's no game here. This is just a... This bill is, I'm part of a loose affiliation of consumer bankruptcy attorneys in Minnesota. They're mostly Democrats, some Republicans. This is a very nonpartisan, non-controversial bill, which is probably why there's not other people here yelling us not to pass it. It's a very common sense bill that updates the state exemptions so that they come into, they're modernized for the way health plans are working nowadays.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll go to member questions now. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is, where did the limit of $25,000 come from?
Mr. Hansen.
Yes. Thank you. Sorry. That was just kind of an arbitrary number. I haven't, because you cannot have an unlimited exemption under the Minnesota State Constitution. Unlimited exemptions are not allowed, so you have to put a dollar amount on it. I could make the argument that they're limited by the annual contributions from the IRS, but that's something that could be litigated. Putting some sort of number on it that's just a number fulfills that constitutional requirement and obviates the need for any litigation on the issue later on between disputing parties.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So originally when I had the bill drafted, there was not a limit, and nonpartisan staff came to my office to fix the situation. We decided on a $25,000 limit. The average in a health savings account is about $14,500, I believe.
Representative Howell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would just say that I think that you put money in the HSA, and especially with the way the stock market has been growing, that can grow very quickly in today's economy. I would say that, if anything, that amount should be raised. But thank you.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Representative Lesh.
So, and I may have missed this part, but either Representative or Mr. Hansen, so what other areas, and this is, as I understand, this is outside of bankruptcy, so garnishments or levies, what other areas besides HSAs receive similar protection under law?
Mr. Hansen.
Thank you. I wasn't quite clear on your question there, Representative Lesh.
Representative Lesh.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Hansen. We're proposing to protect HSAs expressly in statute. Are there other areas expressly in statute that receive similar protection outside of, let's say, bankruptcy protection? My familiarity is mostly, you know, in bankruptcy, right? They can't take your house. I don't know if they can take your pension or not.
Mr. Hansen.
Sorry. The state exemptions can apply outside of bankruptcy and inside of bankruptcy. And inside of bankruptcy in Minnesota, you can choose federal exemptions or state exemptions. The most common time people use state exemptions in their bankruptcy is when there's a large personal injury settlement. Those are protected within areas. That's a whole other complicated area of the law. And then also, the homestead exemption is very high in Minnesota. It's like $365,000 for a homestead. It's almost $1 million for parcels of a contiguous agricultural property up to a certain amount of acreage, like 160 acres. So, yeah, there's the state exemptions has specific exemptions for all kinds of things. The church pew, family library, the family Bible. There's specific, all kinds of very specific things that get protection. This is just a new thing that has arisen, and, you know, you can see that there's ancient things in the exemptions, and then now we have something new that when these exemptions were originally made, people never even contemplated or knew about. I hope that answers your question.
I think it does. Yeah, I didn't know that the housing value was capped at 365, though. So if your house is worth 400, what, they just take 35 grand in equity out of your house as part of the bankruptcy, or what happens there?
Mr. Hansen.
Theoretically, if there was enough meat on the bone there, if you were in a Chapter 7 trustee could sell the property and take the amount over. That those numbers are kind of close. A trustee would probably abandon that. But if you were at 500 and 365, they would take it. But then also, debtors also have an option of filing a Chapter 13 where they can make the best interest of the creditors test and keep their homestead.
Okay.
So there's ways to work around it.
Thank you. Thank you for satisfying my curiosity. I know this is a little bit far afield of the bill, but thank you, Chair. No more questions.
Any other member questions? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, I will renew my motion that House File 2391 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. You're on your way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Franzen. Representative Bliss. Good morning, Representative Bliss.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
I believe you're a freshman. I don't know if you've ever appeared before this committee.
Yes, ma'am. I am in violation of the freshman code of conduct.
Yes.
I ask your forgiveness. Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Bliss.
Madam Chair, I believe Representative Bliss was on notice because yesterday in Veterans Affairs there was a freshman that showed up sans treats. So I think there should be an additional penalty for him not.
All right. Thursday, we expect double treats in this committee.
Yes,
Madam Chair.
Yes. All right. Well, welcome to the Civil on Data Practices Committee, Representative Bliss. I will move House File 1507 and recommend. I'm sorry. That's the one above. House File 368, and recommend that it be re-referred to the General Register. And before we get started, I think there is an amendment to your bill. Is anybody claiming that amendment? Representative Smith?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A4 amendment.
Okay. Would you like to explain what the A4 does?
Sure, yes. This amendment significantly strengthens the bill by ensuring that an aggrieved military beneficiary has the opportunity to take the appropriate legal action for something that has gone wrong for them.
All right, great. Discussion on the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bliss, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My bill is in response to the Attorney General's office brought this to me. There are some unscrupulous companies out there that take advantage of widows and veterans and go to them with a loan for their benefits, and they'll offer to give you the money up front as long as you sign your benefits over to them for a certain period of time. Some of the examples I believe you have in your packet show where it's dimes to the dollar, where they'll take a $5,000 loan and get maybe $35,000 back in payment. This is very, very bad to our veterans, and I appreciate you hearing this bill. Thank you.
Great. Is there any member discussion on the bill? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Good morning. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I'm very pleased to be here to support Representative Bliss's important bill. This is an egregious practice against anyone, but especially against veterans, and I would just point out that the Military Times has covered this story and talked about, and I quote, blatantly deceptive practices to harvest the hard-earned pensions of military personnel. And I really think that this is a critically important bill, and I'm happy to support it. And the amendment, I think, strengthens it, and appreciate it very much.
Right. Thank you. Any questions for this testifier or Representative Howell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I just want to make sure that the intent of this bill isn't to go after those attorneys that represent veterans to get their disability, and then those attorneys get a share of that disability. This is no way have any intent to go after those attorneys and what they do to get the rightful benefits for that veteran.
Is that to the testifier or to the bill author?
I'll go to the testifier.
Okay. Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, no, it is not. It's actually going after these scam lender people who are really ripping off veterans.
Thank you. All right. Any more discussion? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Elwood, so I'm assuming there are some good individuals doing this that aren't charging like 200%, or are there not? And if there are, would this then prohibit them from continuing to do the good, some of them, the good, reasonable loans that they are making?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Dean, these are illegal loans, and so it would be addressing illegal activity. So anybody that's a registered, a licensed lender in Minnesota making a loan to a veteran, just like any other person, would be protected, and those who aren't would be punished under this bill.
Any further questions? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 368 be re-referred to the General Register as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Bliss. We like Dunkin' Donuts here.
Krispy Kreme.
Okay, well, do they even exist anymore?
No, he's going to have to go to South Dakota.
We're not that picky. Representative Smith. I'll wait for your testifier to get to the table. Representative Smith, would you like to move House File 1609? And the motion is that it's going to Commerce.
Yes, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair members. I do move House File 1609, and there also is a DE.
All right. Would you like to move the DE 18 or A18, it looks like?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A18, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, to your bill.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. I do have an oral amendment, Madam Chair, if I could.
All right.
Line 15.515.5. And after the word, between the word of and the, so I would like the line to read, starting with the word act, but the notary public and the notary public's agent must make a copy of, and then insert here the words, the individual's data included in. I repeat, the individual's data included in the electronic. So I'd like to add those five words, Madam Chair.
All right, very good. Does House Research have that written down? Perfect. Representative Smith, what's the reason behind the amendment?
It brings some clarity to this issue, and the testifier could speak to it in more detail if needed. But
okay.
There was some concern about the privacy of the data, and this is in hopes to clarify that.
Okay, perfect. Any further discussion on the oral amendment? All those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. The amendment to the amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill has been the work of many, many months and many stakeholder meetings. And I would like the expert testifier who knows this information very well to briefly summarize the bill for us.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Michelle Timmons, and many of you probably know me as the former reviser of statutes. I'm now retired, but as I considered what to do for my volunteer work in retirement, I thought, I want to stay on the Uniform Law Commission. And so that's what I've done. And in that capacity, I've been leading a group to study the Revised Uniform Law on Notarial Acts, with the acronym of RULONA, and also to discuss whether or not to permit remote notarization using technology in the state of Minnesota, and if so, how. So we created a study group that has been meeting for about 6 months. We started in September of 2017 and have had 12 meetings during that time. The group included representatives from the business community, including the Minnesota Bankers Association, Credit Union Network, Minnesota Land Title Association, real estate companies, and the Minnesota State Bar Association. There were a large number of important government stakeholders from the Office of the Secretary of State, the Commerce Department, the Attorney General, county recorders and examiners of titles, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota Electronic Real Estate Recording Commission, Minnesota State Courts, and the Governor's Office. We also had national notary experts, not only from the Uniform Law Commission, but also from the American Society of Notaries, National Notary Association, and the Pennsylvania Association of Notaries. We had a demonstration of new technology that helps solidify the security and validity of remote notarization from a company called Notarize that also participated in the discussions. At our very recent February 23rd, 2018 meeting of this group, we reached consensus in concept to propose the base act of RULONA with changes to tailor the act to existing law in Minnesota, and also to incorporate a detailed approach with very high standards to allow remote notarization using language that had been crafted by Notarize and based on standards created by the mortgage industry. The result is the delete everything amendment that is before you today. So what we're trying to do is take the best of both worlds, the base act of RULONA, but adding a very detailed, high standards approach to remote notarization. Now, the base language of RLUNA was crafted in 2010 at the Uniform Law Commission and since has been adopted in 9 states, including Iowa and North Dakota in our region, plus Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Washington, and West Virginia. Now, as to the remote notarization piece, Virginia was actually the pioneer state. They began or adopted remote notarization back in 2011. Then when Montana did their RLUNA Act, Montana did something very similar to what's proposed and before you today, to take RLUNA and drop in permission to do remote notarization. Texas and Nevada followed. They will begin to offer remote notarization in 2018. The Indiana Act is on the governor's desk, and that would have a July of 2019 effective date. So I think that is the general background. Perhaps to just to add that the core reason for both RLUNA and the remote notarization is to modernize our Minnesota notarization laws, bring them up to speed with today's technologies, and particularly with the remote notarization, the main policy goal is access, greater access for people who need documents notarized. Using a remote technology allows people who are not in close proximity to a notary to have greater access, and I think over time it could also work very well for people with certain disabilities. I think it really opens up a lot of possibilities for access. Now, with that, I'm prepared not to walk through all the details of the Act, but just to highlight the pieces that are changes from Minnesota law. Would you like me to do that, Madam Chair?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 4, Subdivision 2, which is on lines 13.12 to 13.15, this is a provision that comes out of RLUNA, and it makes it clear that the notary cannot notarize his or her spouse's signature or a document in which either has a direct beneficial interest. This has become a national standard with the new version of RLUNA. It clarifies and adds to Minnesota law what was a discouraged practice but wasn't expressly stated not to be permitted. The main new piece then is Section 15, which, let's see, what page is that on? Page starts on page 8. And this is the new language that I talked about in my opening comments. This is the language that specifically allows the remote online notary public. Now, the remote notary would have to be in the state of Minnesota, but the person who is signing the document could be anywhere within Minnesota, could be in another state, or even in certain circumstances where the matter pertains to something in the United States, the person could be overseas. And that is specifically crafted to deal with problems that have actually arisen with military or military personnel or other Americans who are overseas. So a high standard is required, which requires two forms of identity proofing: showing credentials and using an electronic form of credential analysis, plus an identity proofing that uses questions. If you've recently tried to freeze my credit after the Equifax problem, and I experienced this firsthand where they asked me which of these five places did you used to live? And things like that to verify my identity. Well, that's the kind of thing that is required in the Act. A person who wants to be a remote notary would have to specifically register with the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State's office would add that to their database that already has the names of all the regular notaries and the ones who have applied to deal with the electronic records, and that would be made available to the public on their website. The data, one of the things that Bert Black from the Secretary of State, who you all know is a highly intelligent gentleman, one of the things he spotted is, well, if a notary public is technically sort of a public official, is there a data practices concern? Are they subject to Chapter 13? So the section that is the subject of the Subdivision 11 on page 15, that's the subject of the oral amendment, that paragraph really says, well, they're not subject to, the data collected by these remote notaries is not subject to Chapter 13. But what we tried to do is craft provisions that essentially cause that data to be treated as if it were private data on individuals, so that it's kept private and secure by the remote notary. It's accessible to the subject of the data, or the subject of the data can allow their representatives or a third party to get the data. So that's how the study group came down on it, that, you know, with the many tens of thousands of notaries, many of whom work in the private sector, that people getting their signature notarized probably don't think they're submitting government data the way they might with a driver's license. So perhaps we don't want Chapter 13 to apply, but we want the benefits that accrue to Chapter 13 to apply. So that's how we got to where we are with that provision. Let's see. There is permission within the section for a fee up to $25. The base fee for notary acts, the old paper ones, is still $5. That doesn't change. But with so much technology, there is a cost to that. That $25 rate has been the standard nationally across the country, and it's an up too. So it doesn't have to be that high, but it's the law would set a limit. There's the requirement that an electronic journal must be kept, and there must be an audio and video kept of the transaction, and those must be retained for 10 years. And then there are provisions in the section that talk about what happens if the notary passes away and how that information is still retained for the 10-year retention period. The Secretary of State would also provide a list of courses for study for individuals who wish to become a remote notary to learn the ropes and study what needs to be done to meet this higher standard. So that, I think, is the highlights of Section 15. Section 16 is also new, and there's a lot of language there, but the bottom line is all the people dealing in the real estate agency at our study group said, you know, it would be really great if we could clarify in this act that electronic records dealing with real estate or really anything, but especially real estate, could be printed and offered for purposes like recording of real estate. And so language was taken again from standards created by the mortgage banking industry, and Section 16 permits that. And I just have three more sections to mention briefly. Section 21 tightens our existing law on electronic records by requiring the use of tamper-evident technology. Again, tamper-evident is, it allows for a lot of different methods to create some kind of tamper-evident technology and allows for the development of better methods in the future. But this tamper-evident idea has become really a national standard. It's included in the Uniform Act. It's included in the standards that are hot off the press from the National Association of Secretaries of State, and it clarifies Minnesota law. Section 22 deals with enforcement authority, and it retains the Commerce Department's enforcement under Chapter 45, which is an administrative mechanism. But it really spells out in greater detail the kinds of things that can be enforcement issues in the notary circumstance. And the study group actually went beyond Rulona in one by adding paren 9 on lines 22.5 to 22.7. We added the idea that, you know, if you're a notary because you're a real estate broker and you have a real estate license, or you're a notary because you're an attorney and you have an attorney license, if your underlying professional attorney license is suspended or revoked, well, that could be a factor in determining whether or not your commission to be a notary public can be revoked, which sort of makes common sense, but it was something that the Commerce Department and the Attorney General's office suggested could be spelled out for greater clarity, so we included that. Then finally, I guess I mentioned the Secretary of State's database. Section 23 requires that, and it really outlines the three categories of notaries: the traditional paper notary, the notaries who deal with electronic records, and the new remote notary possibility. And with that, that sums up the highlights
Very
of what
good. Thank
we've
you.
Done.
Thank you. Representative Lushnick, you have a question for this testifier?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Ms. Timmons, welcome back. It's good to have you back here, and appreciate seeing your dedication to public service continue on in retirement as well. This is needed, especially when it comes to laws like this. I had a question related to our codification of the kind of general national standard that you can't notarize something in which you would have a financial interest. And I'm wondering, what impact does that have on a clerical person in a realtor's office or a paralegal in a law office who notarizes a document relating to a settlement agreement, which is going to pay the law firm a percentage, and by which that paralegal would get paid? What's the impact on that?
Ms. Timmons.
Madam Chair, if you would permit, Uniform Law Commissioner Kim Lowe, who is here to talk about business issues, to respond to that question.
Okay, perfect. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape. Thanks.
My name is Kim Lowe. I'm a business law attorney here in the Twin Cities. I'm testifying today in my capacity as a Uniform Law Commissioner, not for the MSBA, which you saw me last week doing. To address your question, and I've been practicing law for 20 years, I am a notary as a lawyer, and I have notaries in my office as well. It's common practice for those notaries to sign settlement, to notarize those documents, and it's never been a question. I've been in very large law firms, and I've been in small law firms, and so this does not change that. This law doesn't change that, and it's just common practice that you would have to have the notary notarize it, who's part of that law firm. Otherwise, we would have people running all around finding independent notaries at the post office. Right. To that extent, this opportunity to use remote notary would allow that outside of office notary if that happens to be the case. But I don't think that the secretary or the paralegal in a law office has that conflict that you're describing.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Lowe, as well, and thank you for being up here on all these bills. I was lucky to work with you on the Public Benefit Corporation piece, and you did a great job on that, so we appreciate having good brains working on this. But that that's kind of what I was getting at. There are certain customs that we have that, sometimes we can pass a law and all of a sudden that's illegal. And so I just want to make sure we're not doing that. And if you're telling me that's not what we're doing, that's good enough for me. Thank you.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with someone, this is a very technical bill. Someone that works better with pictures than all these words, can you, for someone that is, when you talk about the military and being deployed, that really strikes home for me. So if you're over there and you need to do a real estate transaction or some other legal proceeding, how would that remote or electronic notary work for someone that's sitting in Baghdad, let's say?
Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. The demo we saw, the picture was worth 1,000 words, I think. And what we really saw was the fact that the person overseas would get on their smartphone or some kind of computer and go to the notary public site that has the remote notary capability, and they would identify themselves, do an initial identity, like put in the last four of their social. And then that would generate, what you would do is you would get then on essentially a TV screen, almost like a Skype situation with the remote notary. You would answer questions about the, I think you answered questions about the identity first. And then after the identity was verified, then you got the screen with the remote notary, who would, in this case, be back in Minnesota.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So they could do this all on a laptop with the camera on the laptop? They just log into a certain site, and there's multiple companies that have this capability. There's not just one.
Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, that there would not be just one unless only one applied in Minnesota. And one of the reasons why the group decided to move ahead with the remote notarization is the fact that under existing law, Minnesota recognizes notarial acts of other states. So somebody could use the Virginia remote notaries right now, right today. And so with that information, the group decided, well, maybe it is better to move ahead and allow this to occur in Minnesota, craft a detailed law that creates high standards and specifies how this should be done.
Representative, any other member questions? Ms. Lowe, were you here to provide a few words, some testimony, or are you just here for support purposes?
Go ahead. Madam Chair, I'm actually here I sat through 6 months of this as a observer, drafter, participant, and what I sort of took a certain role, and that was sort of the pro-business role of this process, and we heard a lot from a lot of our stakeholders about how important this will be for some of the business activity that we have here in the state, the title companies, the real estate transactions. One thing that's very important to consider is the ability for a notary to notarize documents from his or her, predominantly her home. Well, doing this using technology with a low barrier to entry may provide many job opportunities for women who are, or people who are homebound, who are working from home, who need flexible schedules. Right now, most of our notaries are in our banks or law firms or title companies. And this would provide, this remote notary potentially provides an opportunity for more work opportunities for people outstate or people who aren't necessarily able to get to a workplace. And so from that perspective, it's a win for us as a state. But I also want to mention the fact that the title companies, the real estate companies, the banks, they are dealing with consumers every day who don't necessarily want to have to come in and go to the bank or go to the post office to have something notarized. I don't know about you. I just sold a home recently. I had to notarize a document. I'm a notary, but I couldn't notarize my own document. I had to run over, get it notarized by someone else, file it, sign it, send it in. I didn't attend the closing. They didn't want me there. And that could have been really remedied if I could have done it remotely. and I'm just an everyday average consumer. So the benefit of something like this in Minnesota can be really important.
Okay, thank you. Any other member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify in favor or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 1609 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. You are on your way to Commerce.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero. Welcome, Representative Lucero, and I want to thank you for your work on this. I know it's been a work in progress for a couple of years, and I want to thank your testifiers, too, and all those in the room that have, you know, worked and weighed in on this subject. And I'll probably say from the offset that probably not everybody in the room is real, you know, 100% pleased, but I think it's a good product, and so I'm looking forward to having this hearing. And with that, Representative Lucero, would you like to move House File 1507? And the motion would be that it be re-referred to the Education Innovation Policy Committee.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Right. Okay. And do you have an amendment?
I do, Madam Chair, and I'll offer the DE3.
Very well. Any discussion on the DE3? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE3, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. And Representative Lucero, I think what's being passed out right now is an amendment that you would like to offer in the next committee. And if you want to explain a little bit about what this amendment does, and it didn't meet the deadline, so that's why we're having it offered in the next committee. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will wait for a copy of that myself. I gave my only copy to make the photocopies.
Okay.
So, and the reason I'm having it passed out, and I thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to it passes out so members can look at it. This has been a continuing work in progress, and there continues to be more edits and stuff, and that's what this is. That when I'm just doing the quick walkthrough here, I wanted to have members to have this side by side so they can see as I reference it. So with that, Madam Chair, yes, this has been, so I'm in my fourth year now, second term, and this is something that I've been working on, the topic of student data privacy, since first getting elected. This is an important topic, and it's one that it touches so many different stakeholders, the parents, the schools, technology vendors, and many different stakeholders in between, that it has taken a long time to come to where we are. And it's not a perfect bill at this point in terms of I would like to see more, but the nature of the legislative process is compromised. One of the other things I'm very proud of on this particular topic is that it's not partisan. I have bipartisan co-authors on this because, again, this is important no matter what your philosophical view is. So doing a quick, just some background, we had a bill hearing last year in this committee, so I won't go through the whole background of student data privacy in that sense. Over the interim, we did meet in the Legislative Commission on Data Practices and Personal Data Privacy, and went through another overview on that, and that was a healthy conversation. During that time, then, we received really good feedback from many of the different stakeholders, and that's how the bill went from its first version, 1507, to the DE3. We attempted to incorporate much of that feedback, good feedback from many different stakeholders. At the same time, we rewrote the initial bill that was in the education chapter into Chapter 13. And that's what the DE3 puts the language in Chapter 13. Just a little bit more background. CARE 11 actually last night had a good segment on the topic of student data privacy. I'm not sure why that came up last night. You know, maybe it's coincidence. Maybe they are monitoring the legislature here in the committees. But it was a really good snippet, and it highlighted some of the concerns. So for those who may not have seen the broadcast last night, I highly encourage you go back and see that. We have a fiduciary responsibility, as highlighted in that piece, We have a fiduciary responsibility as technology providers, as school districts, as parents, to ensure that we are offering the highest education possible with as many of the capabilities and technological innovations as possible, while at the same time protecting student data privacy in the process. And that's, again, what some of the motivation here for this is. The objectives of this bill is, as the decades have gone on here, as we've experienced in many walks of our life, innovations have greatly occurred. And those innovations have made our life easier. They've increased efficiencies in areas of our life. They've decreased costs. And that certainly has happened in the educational realm. But at the same time, we need to protect. So the objective is protect student data privacy and ensure parental authority over their children's private data. That's the objective of this bill. So a little bit of my background, just to recap, is I am in the technology space. It's what I do for a living. I've been doing cybersecurity for 15 years, and I am a former teacher. I taught technology courses for 7 years. And the reason I highlight that is because the combination of both my background and my academic teaching background, I am a strong advocate for technology, the use of technology in the classroom, and there's nothing that I would want to do that would hamper the use of technology in the classroom, and this bill doesn't do that. So with that, I'll just briefly run through. Section 1 is the definitions. We have a few definitions that needed to be incorporated in the statute. Section 2 is an audit trail. So what an audit trail is, for those who may not be aware, when actions are performed in a technology system, there has to be a log of the events that occur. Who performed the action? What was what action was performed? The date, timestamp the action was performed. The reason that's important is, as one in the cybersecurity field, I do incident detection and response. In order to respond to potential incidents or data breaches, for example, there's an investigative process, and when investigating the incident that occurred, it's critically important that there's a log of the events. A log of the events allows us to trace what happened, how widespread a data breach or a compromise might be. And absent that audit trail, it's not possible. It really cripples the ability to investigate. Section 3 is training. As many of us are aware, we have multiple hats. I also am a real estate agent, a general contractor, and I have to go through continuing ed. So the education space, there's continuing ed. Things are constantly changing regardless of the field that you're in. And so continuing ed and training are required in many fields. And that's what Section 3 seeks to address, is to because technology is changing at such a rapid pace, and because there's people that are coming into the field constantly, the training on an annual basis will help people maintain their familiarity with their fiduciary responsibility of handling data. Then we get to Section 4. Section 4, I'll just briefly, let's see here. So if I were to go through line 3.18 through 3.22, that's just saying that if you're acting as an agent of the government, you have same responsibility. 3.23 through 3.26 is the breach requirements. And I should mention, one of the things that we did in the rewriting in Chapter 13 is try to harness, to the extent possible, existing Minnesota law. Rather than recreate the wheel and put more into statute, we wanted to take existing statute, which is what you're seeing right here, for example, the breach requirements. We have a breach process, and that's what 13.055 is referencing. When it comes to a technology provider at the end of a contract, for example, it briefly speaks about the requirements to delete data or return the data. Line 4.1 through 4.5 is a technology provider's limitations on the use of the data. Then you're moving down to 4.8 through 4.19. It's nearly identical language to subdivision 13 in the bill, which is simply stating that a standard, policy standards and procedures documentation must exist. So most companies are familiar with, in order to protect systems, you need to have it documented what it is and how it is that you're going to protect. And this is simply a requirement. Subdivision 13 is that requirement on the schools. This section right here, 4.8 through 4.19, is that requirement on technology vendors. Then when 4.2 through 4.24 is parental notification in regards to the use of the data, so informing parents of how their students' data is being used. And it also allows the parent then on an annual basis to opt out of that which they may not want to have their data used by the school or the technology provider. Now, one of the things that, and I neglected here as I was doing the walkthrough, I neglected to reference my amendment to the amendment, so I'll start right here. There is a section where, as you see there on line 4.3, for example, opt out of any program, the amendment to the amendment would insert non-administrative instructional. It's not the intent to opt out of attendance, you know, software or grading software. That's not the intent. It's curriculum. So it's non-administrative or instructional. The next page then, parents will not, or children will not be penalized for opting out. Then getting into section 5, that is the limitations on school-issued devices. And what this seeks to do is ensure that for those devices that are issued by the school and in use by the student, it enumerates that schools cannot remotely turn on GPS, they can't remotely turn on the camera, they can't remotely turn on the audio, the microphone, for example, and with some exceptions. Judicial process, a warrant, exigent circumstance, and then one of the amendments, if you look at the amendment to the amendment, the activity is limited. It allows for an exception for enforcing an acceptable use policy. So schools would be allowed to monitor the web traffic, for example, in order to enforce acceptable use policy. So the intent of this language, again, is when the laptop or the school-issued device is sitting in somebody's home or it's off-site, the schools cannot remotely turn on or enable features without the student's permission or consent. It also does not limit the if the student initiates a connection. It doesn't interfere with curriculum-based activities.
Representative Hilstra?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That doesn't include if it is lost or stolen or the location is in question.
Representative Lucero?
There is that language in here I'm looking for here. 5.19, the student to whom the school-issued device was provided or the student's parent notifies an educational institution or law enforcement agency that the device is missing or stolen. So that then it could. You could enable the camera, GPS, or whatever features might help in locating that device. Okay, then Section 6, the intent of this language is that it would apply to E through 12, public charter and private schools, not to higher ed. And if you look at 6.8 through 6.13, that higher ed is excluded from this. That's not the scope of this bill.
Great. Thank you. I know you have two testifiers with you. Please introduce yourselves for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, excuse me, and committee members, good morning, and thank you for hearing my testimony. My name is Linda Bell. I have two children, and I've been working with MAC for 5 years. Excuse me. Just a few months ago, Carol Levin did a special report on technology in our Minnesota classrooms and found that more than 50% of schools consider themselves to be a one-to-one classroom and found that more than, excuse me, to be a one-to-one classroom where technology is used to teach anywhere from three-quarters of the day to a full day. Carol Levin, excuse me, Carol Levin also stated that the other half of the schools hope to be one-to-one schools very soon. And so it is with this backdrop of the progression of technology across our schools, in all of our classrooms, public and private, that we believe we should become more serious in Minnesota about securing our children's private data, that is, their hopes, their dreams, and their identities. In the October hearing of the Data Practices Commission, a school IT director testified that schools generally work with 35 to 40 or 45 contracts annually, and that the acceptance of third-party model contract language without negotiation is likely occurring in some districts. And so, one of the most important subdivisions of this legislation is the contract between the school and the third party, referring to Subdivision 15, Line 421. I would like to also reference an article, very recent, called New U.S. Department of Ed Finding. Schools cannot require parents or students to waive their FERPA rights through EdTech companies' terms of service, because this is a finding or interpretation of the FERPA law and reveals similarities to our bill and reasons for codifying in law. In January 2018, the U.S. DOE document and their findings concerning EdTech company K-12 Inc. was the first to be issued a USED policy violation. K-12 Inc. was found to be in violation of FERPA due to their practices and policies. This is referred to as the Agora letter, published in November 2017, that serves as a finding or interpretation of FERPA. Agora Charter had contracted with educational company K-12 Inc., which, by the way, we also have K-12 Inc. in Minnesota, and it is also called the Minnesota Virtual Academy, whose terms of the service stated, by posting or submitting member content and student content, whatever they are using when they are on the site, you grant K-12 and its affiliates and licensees the right to use, reproduce, display, perform, adapt, modify, distribute, have distributed, and promote the content in any form. According to USED, the terms of use allowed near universal use and distribution by K-12 and various third party affiliates and licensees of information that could have constituted her child's PII from education records, an outcome that constituted an unlawful, quote, forfeiture of the parents' rights under FERPA to protect against the unauthorized disclosure of PII from her child's education records. In addition, quote, requiring the parent to accept the K-12 Inc. terms of use when she signed up her child for the school constituted a forced waiver of parental rights under FERPA. The concluding finding here is a parent or eligible student cannot be required to waive rights and protections according under FERPA as a condition of acceptance into an educational student, and as well, a parent or eligible student cannot be required to waive their rights and protections under FERPA as a condition of receipt of educational training or services. In the case of Agora, the parent's rights were waived when the parent refused to accept the terms of service. In that case, the parent had opportunity to view the contract. However, across Minnesota, our parents are not given the due notice of third-party contracts, nor have they viewed the contracts. I cannot speak for every district or every situation. I am sure some districts have been more forthcoming, but I am aware of some parents who have requested third-party contracts from their school districts only to find they must file a FOIA. So then this speaks to a transparency issue. HF1507 has been a work in progress for 4 years. It has spurred a lot of research and new understandings of our laws in Minnesota and learning what is important to the workings of our schools. We have appreciated the stakeholder involvement and their comments. Excuse me. HF1507 includes direct and timely notice to parents regarding technology providers working with student ed data. Parents will be notified about the identity of each technology provider with access to ed data. They will identify the ed data affected by the technology provider contract. They will have information on how to inspect the contract. This is very important. We've never had this. Institutions must provide parents and students the opportunity to inspect a complete copy of any contract with a technology provider. And an important opt-out for parents whose school has entered into a third-party contract in violation of FERPA. And lastly, and most importantly, language stating that technology providers must not sell, share, or disseminate educational data. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your support of HF 1507.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead, then. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kirsten Schultz. We as MAC have been working for the last 4 years with stakeholders on HF 1507 to provide necessary protection for our children. The U.S. Department of Education established the Privacy Technical Assistance Center, PTAC, as a one-stop resource for education stakeholders. In a recent finding letter, PTAC states, most importantly, the key stakeholders protected here are the parents and the students themselves. FERPA was written to provide express controls for parents over their children's education records. And this letter shows, while the technology may change, the underlying right is sound and strong. According to FERPA, it is the school's responsibility to provide these protections through its contracts it signs with third parties. The school must maintain direct control over use of FERPA-protected student information. Protected student information, or PII, is defined to include direct identifiers and indirect identifiers, including metadata and even aggregate information, if it can be put together with public or other data to identify a student. In the recent finding letter, it says there are some ed tech services required by schools which are offered directly to students. So it is common practice for parents or eligible students to be directed to download, sign up for, or otherwise enroll in a particular platform, educational product, or online service without the school operating as an intermediary. That requires them to sign terms of service that may not align with FERPA requirements. The letter makes clear that when the school doesn't directly own or manage the student account, the schools must take responsibility to ensure any mandatory ed tech product is used only in compliance with FERPA protections. A parent cannot be directed to consent to an account for their child with insufficient privacy or terms of service terms as a workaround to standards required if the school was directly contracting with the provider. This responsibility is one of the reasons HF 1507 speaks on teacher and staff training in Subdivision 14, as they could be the ones exposing the students or parents to these terms of service. PTAC also states the school and provider should post contracts to promote transparency. These contracts should be posted in a manner easy for parents to find and should include a list of data elements shared with the provider and an exclamation of how they are used. HF 1507 speaks on this in Subdivision 15. We in Minnesota need to move to ensure the privacy of our children is protected. We need to act to assure the federal FERPA laws are being followed by passing our own state statutes. Many of the providers have signed the Student Privacy Pledge and therefore have pledged to follow the same rules as proposed in HF 1507. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your considered support of HF 1507.
Thank you for your testimony. To Ms. Bell and Ms. Schultz, I'm just wondering if you have any estimate of how much time you've invested in this issue. How many hours? Any idea?
Hundreds.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for your testimony. And one more question, and that is, what is PTAC again?
PTAC is the Privacy Technical Assistance Center that the U.S. Department of Education has provided for.
Perfect. And so that was their guidelines. Before you leave, I think we have a member question here. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question goes probably to the author, but the concern, how, you know, you've got a provider with a contract with a school, and now you've got a school with a contract with a college for PSEO. How does this work? How does this law and how does this bill work with that relationship?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So many, you're exactly right. Many of the technology vendors have products in both spaces, E-12 and in higher ed. And we are, so there might be a student record, for example, same student PSEO. That academic record that would exist in the higher ed system would not be in scope. The academic record that would exist in the K through 12 or E through 12 would be under in scope for the protections here.
Representative Powell.
Thank you. But when that college course is taught in the public school, how does this affect that college course being taught in the public school for that college credit?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Powell. This, we don't deal with the curriculum per se. We're dealing with the data that might be the curriculum per se in terms of, when it comes to curriculum, they could opt out. But if they're going to opt out, they won't be taking the course. But when it comes to the data that might be the product of that, the data then would have to be subject to the protections and the requirements that we're speaking about here for records that are contained in the E-12 system, but it would not fall under these same provisions in the higher ed.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I might be the only person here that actually had children within the K-12 Inc. system through the Minnesota Virtual Academy. And when my daughter was 6 years old, and she's now 21, so that tells you how long ago that was. It was the second year that they were even in existence. It was the Minnesota Virtual Academy out of Austin, Minnesota. And I had one in for 5 years in that system, and I had one in for 6 years. And I'm just now kind of comprehending how much data went back and forth, because we had to submit samples of their work, sometimes electronically and sometimes through the mail on a weekly basis, their test scores, unbelievable amount of data transferred back and forth. You know, a total of 11 years between the two of them. So my question is, now that I'm comprehending how much data went back and forth, and I don't even remember signing an agreement. Maybe it was in effect then, maybe it wasn't with the K-12 system, but do you have any evidence that they've used this in any kind of, advertising way or any other way that this company has actually used this data for something? I mean, I can imagine they've amassed massive amounts of information, writing samples and artwork, and I don't even know what they would have an interest in, but have they actually used it for something?
To either of the testifiers, if sometimes you don't know until you may never know if your data is used, but yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, not that we know of, only that you said made this finding that their terms of service were saying that they could use it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Any other member questions for these testifiers? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Representative Lucero. I, too, had the same question about PSEO and college and the schools. But I really want to focus on line 6.12 and 6.13. I think we might need to add a word because someone might be a post-secondary institution, right? And then a technology company provider might contract with a post-secondary institution and also, contract with the Edina school. And just because they have a contract with a post-secondary institution, you don't want to exempt them from a regulation because they happen to also do business with K-12. So I think you need a word to link those two better.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, great minds think alike. And I thought the exact same thing. So I would draw your attention to the amendment to the amendment. And in the amendment to the amendment, 1.16 through 1.18, that is the exact scenario that I attempted to ensure would not happen.
All right.
For purposes of the post-secondary institution activities.
Okay. Perfect. Representative Pugh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lucero, and to all the testifiers for the incredible amount of work that has gone into this bill. My first question was answered in some way by Representative O'Neill's question. I was wondering a little bit more about the Minnesota Virtual Academy, for how long it's been in existence. I think we know that now. Wondering how, if just some more information about this. Wondering how many students are enrolled from all of our various school districts that we represent, and just anyone have any more information about the Minnesota Virtual Academy?
Any of the testifiers know any of those numbers?
No, I can't say that we really do have any statistics on K-12 Inc. or Minnesota Virtual Academy. It was just the very first finding to come out of USED. This is the first time that they've actually gone after a school, mm-hmm. so or the third party.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do have one follow-up question, just unrelated, but I'm wondering if there are any school districts in Minnesota that have a greater appreciation, maybe that's the wrong word, but wondering how many are being proactive, if any, in producing any of this information, making any of this information about third-party contracts accessible to parents. Are there any school districts that any of you are aware of?
Anyone want to take a stab at that question?
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, my children attend a charter school in Maple Grove, and they are very forthcoming with their contracts. But we know a lot of other districts are not.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero.
And if I could add on that same topic, you're specifically referring to the disclosure of contracts. Mm-hmm. There's another piece that is very concerning to me is we consider – the school districts all across the state of Minnesota, we have large school districts and we have small school districts. And whether you're large or small, they're all dealing with the same technology vendors. So you have technology vendors that have teams of lawyers that are dealing with thousands of school districts across the state and have refined their contract language to the point where it would be to serve their purposes naturally. That's what a provider does when they develop a contract language. But then each school, where it becomes a repeatable process for the technology vendors because they're doing it over and over and over again, when it comes to the school districts, they're doing it for the first time. And if they're smaller, they may not have the resources. So it's a David and Goliath. So one of the things that we in this bill, we don't get to the standardization or requirements of contract language, but we do the next best thing, and that is, if we can't standardize the requirements of the contract language, as we have not done, the next best thing is to at least ensure that they're available so that the negotiations that take place with large districts or smaller school districts, it's at least open and accessible for parents to be able to review.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lucero.
Thank you. Thank you to your testifiers. And I believe we have some others wishing to testify. Go to my list. Chris Daniels? Okay. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Ann Taylor. Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for the opportunity to share with you today what I feel is a growing importance regarding today's education with technology in relationship to students, parents, teachers, our school board members, technology providers, and citizens here in the state of Minnesota and throughout the country. As many here know, it was just a few years ago that I and other parents testified before the House and Senate regarding student surveys. This was brought to light when my eldest child in public school began to take note of its ever-increasing and intrusive nature, from electronic student-led surveys to third-party companies, and all without the knowledge or consent of parents of minor children. From that stemmed the conversation regarding student data, its collection, retention, and today here we are with a much-needed bill, the amendment to HF 1507, to ensure those protections while preserving parent rights. I would like to speak first to the contracts found in the school, or lack thereof. In reviewing Minnetonka's electronic technologies acceptable use policy from the year 2014-2015, parents were given direct written information, or otherwise known as what was called this green form. We were originally given this when technology began in the school system. After a couple of years, this paper, transparency, was no longer given to parents. I could easily access it and find it on the parent login page electronically. However, as of today's date, that is not there. It is not readily available or accessible. I can go in on the page and look at it on the website, which helps, But there's a lot of digging to do with it. So it's not direct information that's being given to parents. The district has also opted to inform, like I said, on its school website. It's not easily acceptable. There is no direct communication to parents regarding their child's data, how it's being used, shared, collected, researched, sold, and analyzed. We're simply told, and this is right on the school's website, quote, the student should have no expectation of privacy of materials found on an iPad. Under the law, it is said that the schools are required to notify parents of FERPA, the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, which was severely weakened in 2011 and does little to explain the ever-expanding grossness of technological data sharing, and all without proper and direct parental notification, including notification to the adult, a dependent student who is still attending high school and having reached the age of 18. They are not being notified themselves of what their rights are. My experience has been that parents are not being directly informed of these changes, nor what is our right when it comes to technology use in the classroom with specific regard to data collection and tracking by companies we have never interacted with. In the online world, you can have hundreds of marketers follow you, or in this case, your children, hundreds of marketers follow without ever knowing who the actual players are. Nothing is truly anonymous or confidential when speaking in online terms. As in the case with student surveys, the schools, I'm sorry, but they're lying to both the students and the parents when they state and tell them that surveys are completely anonymous. This needs to stop. This is where it is imperative that annual FERPA training and technology for teachers, staff, volunteers, and school board members is a huge measure in creating transparency and trust. In his book, Data and Goliath, Bruce Schneider puts it this way. It's less about Big Brother and more about hundreds of tattletale little brothers. And that's what's lacking with regard to transparency in the schools when our current laws don't reflect what is rightfully their data and lack of direct parental notification. What continues to concern me is that there is still has not been an audit, from my knowledge, no audit performed on any of our Minnesota Department of Education contractors, some 30-plus of them, in over a decade. And while we have projected solutions for corporations for data sharing and protections on data privacy, we don't hear much on the ever-increasing need for student data protections in education, specifically within the confines of our own schools, within the confines of our schools. As a parent, and on a matter of simple ethics alone, shouldn't we have the right to know who the players are, and more specifically, what these contracts entail and how our children's information is being shared and for what research purpose, including nonprofits? When the EdTech company products are, quote, free, it is you, or our children in this case, who become the product by sacrificing both their data and their privacy. And it does not end in the public schools. I've got a little one who's in private school. They are going to be using technology down the road here. They're using it already in some of their online systems to do assessments. Private schools are under the same guise as the public schools, and I strongly feel they should also adhere to prompt, direct, and full disclosure of the data they are using on my children, on my child, for their educational purposes. I encourage you to please support HF 1507. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself at the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Daniels, and we thank you for considering HF 1507 and allowing us to testify. I'm a father of two school-age children, and as a board member of MAC, I am part of an unfunded, and I think our spouses would say underfunded, grassroots team that has been working tirelessly for 4 years to try and protect all of Minnesota's children in a rapidly evolving technology landscape that we find ourselves in today. We are all too familiar with the challenges we face as a society in regard to the protection of PII, personally identifiable information, in simple day-to-day operations. From credit bureaus to Target, the safety of our privacy is constantly under attack. Key aspects addressed in this bill will provide additional layers of protection that are currently not afforded our children. As we learned in previous testimony last October, our MDE shares our students' information with 35 to 40 partners a year, yet has never gone through an audit to look for any data breaches. This bill will help address this issue. In subdivision 14 of this bill, it addresses another important aspect that can provide some cushion. FERPA training to teachers. As our students are exposed more every day to technology through devices, our teachers can provide a valuable firewall that should help mitigate certain exposures of our children. As previously stated by Ms. Schultz, FERPA specifically states that it is the responsibility of the school to provide the protections of student data. But with new technology, devices, and platforms, as well as other issues teachers deal with on a daily basis, lack of proper training is a weakness. From what data is at risk to how it is at risk are simple but important topics that need to be addressed. Teachers can be an asset for protection as long as comprehensive FERPA training is required and implemented. However, with proper training, teachers can still be undermined if the school contracts involving data sharing are not negotiated with best practices in place. This is one area that even informed parents probably assume is taking place. HF 1507 would ensure that teachers, administrators, technology directors would all receive annual training that would provide guidance and understanding important best practices in handling student data. Part of the data sharing issues that the contract should address are ensuring that any third parties that view our children's data are not selling or sharing data in a blind spot to the parents or the schools. Subdivision 15, line 4.1 directly addresses third parties forbidding them from selling, sharing, or disseminating our children's personally identifiable information. Our children's data should never be fodder for profit. This bill is important in addressing many privacy issues that the new frontier of technology and education has exposed. On behalf of all Minnesota children, I ask you to support, ask you for your support on HF 1507. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either of these testifiers? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Next up is Ben Feist. On deck is Alexi Maiden. Hope I've said that right. We do have about 15 minutes left, folks, so if we could keep that in mind as we go, as you present your testimony, that would be appreciated. Go ahead,
Madam,
Mr. Feist.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. Many of you have heard from me before on this topic, and I will be brief today. We started to get involved in this area with an understanding that we're at a point where parents and students should be able to take control of their personal data in a time where it's kind of gotten out of hand. We initially started work in this area trying to target student information systems and one-to-one devices specifically. Over the course of the last several years, a bill that was once, I think, 16 pages has been whittled down substantially, trying to deal with lots of different stakeholder issues and concerns. And I want to thank Representative Lucero for being open to those discussions and for continuing to try to keep the heart of the bill intact. This is definitely a bill that I support and is still moving in the right direction. I do think there are areas that are limited and we may need to return to in the future to address some of the issues that we've noted previously. But I like where this is going. By moving everything into Chapter 13 specifically, I hope that we have a different concept of what educational data is. And hopefully that means that new technologies coming in that we haven't even thought of yet could be covered under this same framework so that we don't necessarily have to return to the legislature every year that there's a new type of device or online technology that we need to deal with. But with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any member questions? Thank you, Mr. Feist.
Thank you.
Alexi Maiden, and on deck is Sarah Cloak. Good morning.
Chair,
please state your name for the record.
My name is Tony Close, and I have the honor of representing CompTIA, or the Computing Technology Industry Association. It's a national trade association that represents over 100,000 members worldwide. We specialize in professional certification programs for the IT industry, as well as representing our members' interests at various state capitals throughout the United States. I will be very brief. First of all, I wanted to thank you, Representative Lesh, for your leadership on this, but I really wanted to thank Representative Lucero. As you said, it's been an ongoing conversation for 3-4 years at least. I know in your committee, as well as we spent some interim hearings in the Legislative Commission on Data Practices, so I know that you were all in there on that, and want to thank you for that. And for Representative Lucero, who has had an open door policy, and as, even as late as 8 o'clock last night, we were still having conversations. So he has been great in trying to get all of these stakeholders together. And, that, and there's two things here that it's really hard to thread this needle is. As you've heard, when I went to school, it was just a textbook. It was a textbook and a chalkboard. And as Representative and I have had these conversations, things have changed now. It's laptops. It's computers, it's websites, it's apps. And so we've got those that are constantly changing and churning, and also the stakeholders that are involved. And you've heard some of the parents go through, the industry, the parents, the students themselves, the ACLU, school boards. So trying to thread that needle has been tough, and he's been working really hard at doing that. We thank him for that. But student data privacy is the top priority for the industry, and I just wanted to let you know that we have the shared goals, and how we get there, we might have different variations on how to do that, but I think we all have the shared goals of protecting student data privacy. We've done it in 20 other states, using 20 other states' language, along with existing state statutes and federal law, Madam Chair. And so I just wanted to let you know, I'm going to turn it over to Sarah and Alexi, and let them kind of elaborate a little bit on more on the 20 states that have gone on and what some of the Fed folks are working on, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. My name is Alexi Madden. I'm the Director of State Government Affairs for CompTIA. As Tony just outlined, we are a national trade association that represents the technology industry. I also want to extend my thank you to Representative Lucero, who's been very open and listening to us and understands the technological challenges behind it because of his background in the security industry. And we are most thank you. Most thank you to the parents as well. We've spoken to them several times through our representatives here on the ground, and we continue to have good conversations with them. I wanted to talk about student privacy in the national aspect. Tony is correct. 21 states have currently passed language around student data privacy. A lot of it emanated out of what's called the Student Privacy Pledge. My colleague here from SIIA, and as well as the Future Privacy Forum, worked together in 2014 to provide language that now currently has 329 signatories of edtech providers that promise three main things. One, that they will not advertise to students in the classroom. Two, that they will not amass a profile of data about students to be used for anything other than the technology that's being used itself. And then also three, not to sell, rent, or lease data to third parties with some legal exceptions. That pledge was so instrumental in the spurring of this legislation in the 21 states that's passed it. We look to that language as a more holistic approach. It has these very specific bans on what you can and cannot do with the student data, but also takes it from more of a technology aspect with the security baked into the laws there. excuse me. HF 1507, we've worked with Representative Lucero to share our concerns. He's seen the language that has been done in other states, and he understands the perspective that we're coming from. Unfortunately, at this time, we still have to oppose HF 1507 because we do feel that it is a little too prescriptive in some circumstances. For example, I know you mentioned the audit trail earlier. That's currently a best practice in technology, and we very much appreciate you bringing it to the forefront. But what's best practices now may not be best practices in 2 years. They may come up with something new and exciting and that can better authenticate who's using the data and when. So what we as CompTIA, as a national trade association, try to do is to make sure that legislation that's passed is technology neutral so that it does allow for innovation, it does allow for new best practices to come to light, but that it doesn't stifle us by making us held to 2018 standards when 2022 standards might be drastically different. And then lastly, one of the things that we've picked up in our conversations with the representative, with our conversations about the parents is, there seems to be an overlap of what information should be given from the education technology providers, and we definitely think that there is some. And Sarah here is going to talk about what's already being required by federal law. But then also what information should be disseminated by the districts and opt-out procedures and what can be collected by the districts. And the woman before was talking about the surveys. That's more oriented at the school districts themselves. And so we feel perhaps two different bills should move forward out of this, one that addresses the school districts and the data that they have and what can be done on their side of the coin, and then what the ed tech providers have to be measured up to. So I'm going to stop right there. I'm going to hand it off to Sarah, who's going to give us a primer. She's a subject matter expert on federal privacy law.
Please state your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Sarah Cluck. If I just use my big girl voice and talk into the mics while they pick it up. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm really happy to be here today. I'm actually based in D.C., but am a proud graduate of the University of Minnesota Morris and the Stillwater Area High School. So I got to see my niece tonight, and when I was telling her that I was here, she said, "I don't care about that." So I don't have her blessing, but I'm happy to be here. I really appreciate the work you've done on issues important to Minnesota families, schools, educators, and the technology community. I am also a certified information privacy professional, and most recently prior to this job I'm in was at the U.S. Department of Education's Office of the Chief Privacy Officer, working with the Privacy Technical Assistance Center, so I'm happy to answer any questions you might have on PTAC and my experience there. I loved it. They do really great work. I'm also happy to talk about the Agora Cyber Charter Letter, as I worked on that while I was at the Department of Education. But I will get into my remarks because I know we are limited in time. The education technology industry shares an ever-important goal in protecting every student's education data and ensuring every student has access to the tools necessary to receive a world-class education. A strong network of laws, contracts, and business practices now does that. SIA helped develop the Student Privacy Pledge, which is now signed as of today by over 325 school service providers, which clarify commitments to the appropriate use of student data and meet legal responsibilities and community expectations. I do want to take some time to talk a little bit about FERPA and provide some background on that. FERPA was passed many decades ago as a response to provide parents access to information. At its core, FERPA gives parents rights to access information stored at the school about the students. In order to share data, schools need to get parental consent to share data with anyone outside of the school. There are some exceptions to that. I know folks referred to the directory information exception earlier. There is a school official exception, which allows schools to bring in school volunteers and other and contractors that might have access to student data, but it's a very limited scope in which the schools are able to share data with a school official. There's four pillars that school official must meet. It must perform an institutional service that would otherwise be performed by a school a person at the school. It must meet the school official criteria, which should be outlined in the annual FERPA notice that parents should receive from a school district every year. That's required by FERPA. The school official must be under the direct control of the school, so all of the data and everything that is stored by the school official, often it is an ed tech company, must be under the direct control of the school district. And the ed tech company or school official volunteer must only use the information they receive for an authorized purpose. That authorized purpose is often outlined in the contract that is negotiated between the school and the technology provider. Also mentioned earlier was the Agora Cyber Charter Letter, and since that relates directly to FERPA, I did want to mention that the complaint was first filed in 2012, before most of the student privacy laws at the state level were passed. It took a long time to investigate, and when the department announced their findings earlier this year, it was a result of six years of investigations of the cyber charter school and their subcontractors that they use. It is a big decision, but it is not the first decision that the Department of Education or finding that the department has made under FERPA. They receive hundreds of complaints every year through their Privacy Technical Assistance Center. Oftentimes those complaints or questions are coming from parents and educational technology companies and schools asking for help and on how to comply and with FERPA and student privacy laws and find best practices for complying with student privacy laws. The one thing that PTAC isn't able to do is provide guidance on how to follow state privacy laws. So because they aren't the experts on how to comply with state privacy laws. So the one thing that I did want to mention is the importance of harmonization. When EdTech providers are looking, small or large, are looking for best practices in compliance, they will call the Privacy Technical Assistance Center or look to guidance like the Student Privacy Pledge on how to comply with these laws. So I want to speak to the idea of harmonization across the country and hoping to encourage the committee and the importance of harmonizing Minnesota's laws with other laws so that we don't create conflicting requirements so Minnesotans don't lose out on access to innovative educational materials simply because the technology company and the educators couldn't figure out how to meet the requirements of the bills. I'm happy to answer any questions, but also happy to be here.
Are there any member questions? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see this, the K-12 school service provider pledge. What are the ramifications if they violate this pledge, the tech companies?
So that's a clock. So that is a public pledge, and they are subject to Section 5 law, federal law. The Federal Trade Commission can investigate if they violate that law and sue them.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So everything in here is part of the law? It's not just a pledge?
The pledge is, so Section 5 says that is the provision of federal law that prohibits unfair and deceptive trade practices. So going against a public pledge you make would be considered a deceptive trade practice by the Federal Trade Commission. They've gone after companies before for writing one thing in their privacy policy and doing another thing. And since this is a public pledge, they're listed on the website. If companies are unable to, not living up to the promises of the pledge, then the Federal Trade Commission is totally within their scope to investigate.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how many companies have been prosecuted by the Federal Trade Commission for violation of this pledge?
So the pledge came out in 2014, and it's 2018, and the federal government moves not that fast. So there haven't been any public places settled publicly. I've never been at the Federal Trade Commission, and I'm not. They don't discuss cases that are either settled outside or are in progress. So I don't know if there's any in progress.
Thank you. Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is a good bill. The making a point of saying we shouldn't move forward with this because it may change in 2022. It's technology. It's always going to change. We need to do what's right now, and if we need to adjust later, then we adjust later. We kind of got to clean the fish in front of us. But I come from the insurance industry, and the data that's collected, even on kids, it's spooky. So I can have someone come in for auto insurance, and they just get their driver's license, and some of the factors that their rate is based on isn't their driving record, isn't their grades. It's who are they connected to online in Snapchat, Facebook, all this data that's going on, whether it's valid or not, I don't know, but it's disconcerting how much information they are already getting out to quote-unquote affiliates. And a lot of it's through the school electronics, and I think this is very important to move forward with.
And I just had a couple of comments on the Ms. Cluck stated that PTAC can't advise on state privacy laws, and that's okay with me because I want each state to have its own structure so that it's more accountable and transparent to the people that it's closest to. So I appreciate the work that PTAC does, but we need state authority as well for our constituents. And as I wanted to ask Ms. Madden, you had stated that that your policy is that you don't sell to students in the classroom. Can you clarify what that statement means? You don't sell to students in the classroom. Does that mean you don't sell?
We don't
to them while they're in the classroom, or you don't sell to? Explain.
The pledge requires that no advertising is to be done through educational technology products.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And okay. Any other member questions for these testifiers? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We have a couple of testifiers left. Joel Verduin from Anoka Hennepin Schools, the Chief Technology and Information Officer, and Grace Kelleher. And we are over time, folks, so if you could, if you could abbreviate your testimony, that would be great, if you could be really concise. Welcome, Mr. Verduin.
Thank you,
Appreciate you being here again today. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joel Verduin. I'm the Chief Technology and Information Officer with the Anoka Hennepin School District. I had several points, but I think the amendment to the amendment actually ended up clarifying several of the points that I would make, so I will be very brief. One of the first points that I had planned to make was on the audit log requirement of the bill, knowing that the audit logging features of a lot of our software aren't 100% complete and compliant with the exact language in here, particularly when it comes to access. When somebody just looks at a record, a lot of times audit logs will be incomplete in terms of just looking at a record. So in a district of our size, there's probably about 500,000 views to student information in a given day. Just the act of taking attendance will get up to 100,000 record reviews. And so that was very onerous looking at it. The amendments to the amendment does give a waiver for software that was purchased before a certain date. But my concern would still remain that future software vendors can actually comply completely with that, as well as a number of professionals who use other ways of getting to that data without using the actual software application. For example, we pull data an awful lot, so that will put a requirement on us to do a lot of logging manually, as the software doesn't necessarily take that into account. The training, I agree that training is never enough, and we do always look for ways to conduct that training. Requiring it obviously comes at an expense of either time or cost for us. So training for 1 hour with our district's teachers, which is about 3,000 teachers, 1 hour of training is going to cost us somewhere in the $60,000 to $90,000 range if you take hourly salaries into account. Again, I'm not opposed to training. I think it's a good idea. It's just a matter of finding the time for that. So when it's required of us, that puts a burden in front of us that we have to get through.
Mr. Verduin, if I could interrupt you just real briefly there, how often do you train your staff and teachers on this sort of subject matter as far as accessing data?
Every year we produce a flyer and a pamphlet regarding student information safety, and so that goes out to all of our teachers, all of our staff. It goes out to teachers, paraprofessionals, and everybody else. Now, where it falls short of training is there's no check the box to guarantee that you read it, the time provided to actually go through maybe a training video. So we kind of do the best that we can with the time we have in order to update people annually on any changes, as well as the full barrage of all the things that relate to FERPA directory data and their rights and responsibilities in terms of use of data.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Sure. One part that I hope to have a little bit more clarity on when it comes to the opting out piece is the administrative non-instructional, the definition between those two. So perhaps definitions attached
okay.
to those.
Okay.
Would at least give people some information that a lot of products kind of cross into both. And so we would need to figure out how that's going to work when some products kind of handle some administrative functions and sometimes they're instructional at the same time. The last point that I would make, and maybe this one could just be helped with a little bit of clarification as well, when it comes to students and their laptops and privacy, I am very happy that we have acceptable use policy language in there, because oftentimes what we do with students is when they're in violation of school rules or policies, not quite, you know, to the point where a warrant is accessible, and so the addition of that in the amendment to the amendment is very helpful. I am hoping that it covers the idea that a lot of times we don't know that it's a policy violation, but we suspect that it might be. at that time. So that's generally one of the reasons we go into that investigative process, is to find out if they really did violate school policy. So we want to be able to do that when that happens. Completely agree on a number of topics in here. Students and their privacy is important to me as well. We just try to balance that with maintaining a safe school environment and all the other things that we have to do. Lastly, I just am speaking in support of the contractual obligations included. I think that's very helpful language to have, the number of contractual pieces that should be in place, that should be required of those vendors that are working with us to make sure that they don't sell, trade, or market to our students. We look for that as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much. Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chair and members, I just think the testimony in front of me did a great job, and I don't have anything to add to it, and we'll continue. I want to thank Representative Lucero for working with us, and a lot of our definitional questions and how it rolls out in the classroom we can talk about in education.
Perfect. Thank you. Any further questions? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none. Representative Lucero renews his motion that House File 1507 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Education Innovation. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Lucero and testifiers. We are adjourned.